Today, cloudy, highs near 40 to 42 degrees, slight chance of rain in the afternoon.
Let the Senate look at it. Let anybody look at it.
After an about-face from President Trump, the House prepares to vote to force the Department of Justice to release its so-called Epstein files.
For Monday, November 17th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. White House pressure is leading companies large and small to scale back diversity efforts.
Ahead, we'll meet a group in Chicago working to keep up the pressure for more inclusivity in hiring.
We have an administration that is trying to turn back the clock on progress it has taken decades to achieve.
And a comet streaking through the solar system has caught on in pop culture, generating wild theories and speculation.
We will look at what, if any, of the hype is legitimate.
I think it's an interesting object. But it's a comet. It's not an alien spaceship.
First News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. A federal judge says the Justice Department may have engaged in profound investigative missteps in its prosecution of former FBI Director James Comey. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports the judge has ordered prosecutors to turn over all grand jury materials to Comey's lawyers.
Comey was indicted by a grand jury in September on false statements and obstruction charges tied to his congressional testimony in 2020. His attorneys have requested the grand jury materials, arguing that irregularities may have tainted the prosecution. Now, Magistrate Judge William Fitzpatrick has granted that request. In an opinion, Fitzpatrick says the record, quote, points to a disturbing pattern of profound investigative missteps that led an FBI agent and a prosecutor to potentially undermine the integrity of the grand jury proceedings. This is one of several ways Comey is challenging the Trump Justice Department's case against him. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump says he would sign a bill to force the Justice Department to release files in the case of convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. NPR's Franco Ordonez reports the House is expected to vote on it tomorrow.
President Trump says the case has turned into a distraction from his administration's work.
Let the Senate look at it. Let anybody look at it. But don't talk about it too much because, honestly, I don't want to take it away from us. It's really a Democrat problem. The Democrats were Epstein's friends, all of them. And it's a hoax.
Trump and Epstein were friends until they had a falling out several years before Epstein's first conviction. For months, Trump and his supporters fought to block the vote on releasing the Epstein materials, but it became increasingly clear that it would pass anyway. And this weekend, in a dramatic change of course, Trump called on House Republicans to support the measure. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, The White House.
Overdue economic data are expected this week. NPR's Scott Horsley reports that includes late summer tallies of exports and imports and a snapshot of the job market in early fall.
Now that the federal shutdown is over, government statisticians will start to release those economic report cards we've been missing for the last 6 weeks. The Commerce Department says it will provide an update on the August trade deficit on Wednesday. The Labor Department will deliver the September jobs report the following day. Both of those reports were supposed to come out in early October. No word yet on when or even if we'll see data on inflation or unemployment for last month, which could help to shape the Federal Reserve's decision on interest rates in December. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The UN Security Council has approved a U.S.-authored plan creating an international stabilization force for security in Gaza. It also envisions a possible path to an independent Palestinian state. The vote was a crucial next step for the ceasefire and efforts to outline Gaza's future after 2 years of war between Israel and Hamas. You are listening to NPR News from Washington. The acting chief of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, David Richardson, has left his post just 6 months into the job. It's the latest development in a year of departures and policy changes at the agency. His leadership was questioned after he delayed responding to deadly floods this summer in Texas. The U.S. got a D-plus grade for maternal and infant health, according to a new report card from the March of Dimes. As NPR's Maria Godoy reports, the U.S. has one of the highest rates of premature births among developed nations.
About 1 in 10 babies born across the U.S. last year was premature. And those rates were much higher in some U.S. states, including Mississippi and Louisiana, and for certain racial and ethnic minorities, especially Black women and infants. The March of Dimes report also found about 1 in 4 pregnant women didn't receive prenatal care in their first trimester, a decline from previous years. Meanwhile, the prevalence of pre-existing chronic conditions like hypertension and diabetes increased. Both are known risk factors for preterm birth. The March of Dimes says the findings should be a call to improve systemic inequities and access to care across the country. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Brazil's vice president says Brazilian goods like coffee, beef, and tropical fruits still face a 40% tariff in the U.S. That's despite President Trump's decision to remove some import taxes on countries in an effort to boost the U.S. economy. Trump imposed additional tariffs on Brazil due to the trial of former President Jair Bolsonaro. I'm Ryland Barton. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Cy Sims Foundation. Since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
It is 5:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. We receive support from Clockow Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, making traditional old-world styles of beer, as well as modern classics, for 7 years now. Their tap room is open Monday through Thursday, 3 to 8, Friday and Saturday, noon to 8, and Sunday from noon to 6. More info at clockoutbrewing.com. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE-KBXE news team.
Considered from NPR News, I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The story of President Trump and the Epstein files has taken over American politics, but it's also been a lot to follow, so here's a short summary.
Yeah, I would. All right. I guess I would.
Campaigning to return to the White House, Trump was asked whether he declassified the information gained from the federal investigation into accused sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. He said yes, though he tempered that by saying he did not want to affect people's lives if those files contain, quote, phony stuff. Once in office, Trump changed his message.
I don't understand why the Jeffrey Epstein case would be of interest to anybody. It's pretty boring stuff.
That stance only led to even more documentation of the relationship between Epstein and his one-time friend Donald Trump through media reports and through bipartisan efforts in the House Oversight Committee. A handful of Republicans joined Democrats in pushing for legislation to compel the Department of Justice to release its Epstein files. And despite intense lobbying from the White House to get those Republicans to back off, they forced the House of Representatives to vote on it this week. And then, last night, Trump changed his message again. He posted on Truth Social saying, quote, House Republicans should vote to release the Epstein files because we have nothing to hide and it's time to move on from this Democrat hoax, end quote. Kentucky Republican Thomas Massey and California Democrat Ro Khanna jointly led the effort to force the floor vote, and Congressman Ro Khanna joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
What was your response to that latest post from President Trump? Did it surprise you that he's now calling for the House to approve this legislation?
It did surprise me, but he saw the math. He caved to the coalition that Massey and I have built over the past 5 months. Look, this is one of the most horrific crimes in American history. You had Jeffrey Epstein, who had a rape island. You had rich and powerful men who basically abused underage girls or knew about that abuse and said nothing. And we were able to build such a strong coalition that there were probably nearly 100 Republicans who would have voted for my bill, my underlying bill, despite the president's bullying them to get off. And the president saw the reality.
Trump, of course, doesn't need the House vote to release the files, right? So what is the goal here at this point in time?
Well, the goal is to show that there is an enormous coalition in this country that wants the Epstein class removed, that we stand with forgotten Americans and not the Epstein class, and that a overwhelming vote in the House and the Senate is going to put enormous pressure to release these files. We're having survivors at the Capitol tomorrow, and this is something they've been wanting for decades. They deserve justice.
What do you mean by the Epstein class?
I define the Epstein class narrowly as the people who either abused underage girls or who knew about Epstein's abuse and covered it up. But more generally, the Epstein class is a group of people with extreme wealth who have donated to politicians and been part of a system where they think the rules don't apply to them. And they have created a system that has shafted a lot of forgotten Americans. That's why Donald Trump ran in and was central to his campaign. And many people, like Marjorie Taylor Greene and others, believe he's become part of the swamp that he said he would drain. He's forgotten the forgotten Americans he said he would stand up for.
I want to ask you to respond to, I'm sure you've heard this criticism many times. There are a lot of supporters of President Trump who say that Democrats only got interested in this ongoing story when it became clear that it could politically damage President Trump. What's your response to that claim?
Well, first of all, I spoke out about this in 2019 with Elijah Cummings, and people can look at my social media about it. And then during President Biden, there was a judge-ordered process of releasing files. But what Donald Trump then said is he wants to expedite that and release all of them. J.D. Vance said this multiple times. I did not criticize him once in the first 6-7 months. The only time I spoke out with Thomas Massie is when Pam Bondi went on television and said, well, we've released everything. It's time to move on. There's nothing more to see. And that's when we mobilized, and our hope was that we would get President Trump back then to see that he needed to fulfill his commitment to release the files. We never made this about Donald Trump. The survivors have not made this about Donald Trump. This is about justice for the survivor, protecting our kids, and exposing one of the most horrific, disgusting scandals in our country's history.
There were 20,000 pages of documents that were released last week, but that was not the DOJ files. That included everything from the emails where Epstein said that Trump, quote, knew about the girls to, you know, lots of exchanges between prominent Democrats, among others, with Jeffrey Epstein. Do you have any idea what is in the DOJ files themselves? Like, what do you expect if you do get your wish?
Well, what I know is from what the Epstein survivors' lawyers say, because they've seen the files. There are photographs of lewd acts that took place. There are interview memorandum with rich and powerful men who either engaged in sex trafficking or actually showed up to Epstein's island. There is numerous emails and records from Epstein's own computers that would show who was friends with him and taking money from him despite knowing that he abused underage girls.
I think that President Trump's insistence that the DOJ investigate Democrats mentioned in last week's files is the latest example of the political interference that's taking place at DOJ. Given that, how would you approach verifying whatever the Department of Justice eventually turns over? Would you have concerns about what DOJ turns over?
I do have concerns. I've said that the process should be non-politicized, non-partisans. If Democrats are implicated, so be it.
I'm just talking about the factual information, though. How would you make sure that these are, in fact, the full files? Is there conversation about that?
There is, and the way to make sure is that we have lawyers who've seen the files, the victims' lawyers. They should be involved. There are people from Biden's Justice Department who've seen the files. There are career officials who've seen the files. And, by the way, we're getting documents from Epstein's estate, which are independent. And so if the Trump administration tries to tamper with the documents, there are a lot of external validators who've seen the files would be able to call that out.
Very, very quick question. Do you feel confident this would pass the Senate if it clears the House?
I do. We just heard from Senator Merkley that he's going to bring this up. And we have bipartisan support there.
That is Congressman Ro Khanna of California. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There is an unusual alliance recently between space geeks, sci-fi fans, and the high-profile personalities Kim Kardashian and Joe Rogan. They all share an interest in a newly discovered interstellar object. NPR's Katie Riddle reports on the celebrity comet called 3I Atlas.
Scientists discovered 3I Atlas earlier this year. It's a visitor from another solar system, traveling much faster than the local comets that orbit our sun. The composition of 3I Atlas suggests its home is somewhere much colder than ours. But exactly what these unique features tell us, that's been a matter of speculation. Here is podcast host Joe Rogan in a recent interview.
Initially, a lot of people were dismissing your concerns, and they were saying that this object is nothing but a comet, and it's very normal. But then as it got closer and as we got more data, it seems like you're correct.
Rogan is interviewing Avi Loeb, an astrophysicist at Harvard. Loeb is responsible for a lot of the recent frenzy around 3i Atlas. In media appearances like this, he's made grandiose suggestions about the comet, even implying that it could be carrying alien life forms.
This is different than other scientific matters, and the intelligence agencies know very well that events with very small probability have to be considered seriously because they could have major implications.
In an interview, Loeb maintained the claim that 3i Atlas could be evidence of intelligent beings from another planet.
So all I'm saying is, let's leave this possibility on the table, collect as much data as possible out of curiosity, and figure this out.
His theories have ricocheted around the internet. Kim Kardashian recently said on the platform X, quote, "Wait, what's the tea on 3i Atlas?" This prompted NASA Administrator Sean Duffy to respond, "Great question." He then explained that 3i Atlas has, quote, "no aliens and does not present a threat to human life on Earth." Some in the astronomy world have reacted to Loeb's claims more vehemently.
Honestly, I think it's a way to get attention. And it's very successful.
David Jewett is an astronomer at UCLA who also studies 3i Atlas.
I think it's an interesting object, but it's a comet. It's not an alien spaceship.
There are some amazing things about 3i, says Jewett. For one thing, we've only seen three objects that have come from outside our solar system. He calls them interstellar interlopers. Jewett says these kinds of objects are whizzing around all the time. It's just that we can see them now, thanks to more powerful telescopes.
And if we can figure out something about them, then maybe we can figure out something about some other place in the galaxy that we have really no other way to access.
Another thing, says Jewett, it's likely very old, like 8 or 10 billion years old.
So it's been drifting out there for an incredibly long time, longer than we've been around, longer than our sun has been around. And that in itself is fairly amazing.
Jewett says there are likely many more of these interstellar interlopers to study in the future.
It's a staggering number of objects floating around, the presence of which we've only just started to infer.
He's glad that people are interested in space. He also thinks it's important to maintain skepticism and rigor in public discussions of science.
I think you have to pay close attention to the data and to what you see, and you have to be honest. And I think that applies to everybody.
Among other reasons to pursue truth, he points out, sometimes it's more wild than anything we humans can imagine. Katia Riddle, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on member-supported radio, KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE-KBXE news team. Support for KAXE comes from the IM Hotel in Grand Rapids, providing access to local attractions and outdoor activities like fishing and bike trails. Additional information available at imhoteltimberlake.com. And don't forget our question of the week. Our new season watch pod explores nature as the seasons change. How do you change when fall turns to winter? Text 218-326-1234. The Arrowhead Library System presents Songs of Mesabi, a musical journey through the Iron Range with Greg Tibberzy, now through December 10th. Find a list of dates, times, and locations at alslib.info. The Minnesota Department of Transportation will hold an open house about the Highway 34 corridor study tomorrow from 4 to 6 at Park Rapids City Hall. Take part in a community read-in at the Bemidji Public Library from 5 to 6 p.m. Mondays in November. Gather to read quietly together, demonstrate support, and celebrate the library. Coats for the Community will distribute winter gear for those in need tomorrow from 5 to 7 at St. Peter's Catholic Church in Park Rapids. Itasca Housing Resource Team hosts Soup on the Street Wednesday, November 19th on the grounds of Old Central School in Grand Rapids from 3 to 5 p.m. Stand in solidarity with those experiencing housing insecurity and hunger. Donations of hats, mittens, and scarves will be accepted, and soup will be served. The mountain bike trails at Tioga Recreation Area near Cohasset are closed now through November 23rd due to deer hunting. Now back to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a comprehensive wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. From AT&T, a network that is making connections for Americans. Connecting changes everything. Learn more at att.com/YATT. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. President Trump's war on diversity, equity, and inclusion is reaching far beyond the federal government. Many employers have ended their DEI programs. Universities and community groups have lost funding for equity-related work. But one small nonprofit is fighting back. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports from Chicago.
Under a warm sun this fall, a raucous gathering. Thousands of female construction workers joined a mile-long parade celebrating gains they've made in an industry still dominated by men. The women carried banners proudly announcing their trades: plumbing, carpentry, painting, roofing. And leading the parade was a drumline, a dozen or so women in fluorescent yellow vests and hard hats. They are the staff of Chicago Women in Trades, a nonprofit established in the 1980s. Its mission is to promote equity by getting more women into good-paying union construction jobs. 70% of its participants are Black and Latina. So behind the celebration, there are grave concerns. Chicago Women in Trades has worked to recruit, train, and place women in construction jobs since Ronald Reagan was president. Now President Trump could bring its demise. Back in January, Trump signed a pair of executive orders cracking down on what he sees as widespread and illegal use of, quote, dangerous, demeaning, and immoral race and sex-based preferences. He cut funding for DEI-related work and told government contractors and grantees to end programs promoting DEI. Chicago Women in Trades Executive Director is Jane Valinga.
We have an administration that is trying to turn back the clock on progress it has taken decades to achieve.
But her group is not letting that happen without a fight. Early this year, Chicago Women in Trades sued the government over Trump's executive orders, which threaten its very existence. The nonprofit relies heavily on federal grants, and more damaging may be the provision that requires contractors and grantees to certify that they're not promoting illegal DEI. They could face civil and criminal penalties if they report false information. Jane Valinga says that's caused great confusion.
There's a lot of threats out there, but no clarity about what actually is illegal DEI. And it is unclear how the industry or anyone is going to respond to it.
Already, the United Brotherhood of Carpenters disbanded its Sisters in the Brotherhood program. For decades, the program gave women carpenters a space to build networks and share ideas for how to overcome barriers. In a memo, the union's president wrote that current policies targeting identity-based initiatives put the program at legal risk. It's been replaced with a member engagement program open to all. Now, talk to female construction workers around Chicago, and you get a sense of how women-focused programs have changed lives. Kat Trudy and Charlie Willoughby are second-year plumbing apprentices. They say Chicago Women in Trades is the reason why they have promising careers.
I 100% yes, believe so,
yes,
yeah.
Yes.
They both came through the nonprofit's free 10-week program, where they got an introduction to the gamut of construction trades and acquired some basic skills, such as measuring and blueprint reading.
We learned about tool safety, tool handling.
We had to work out as well.
Every day we worked out.
We had to work.
Chicago Women in Trades partners with unions and contractors to ensure graduates like them a future in the industry. But if Trump's executive order stands, all of this could fall apart. Now, because of the ongoing legal battle, Chicago Women in Trades has been able to hold on to some of its federal funding. And a lower court said for now, Labor Department contractors and grantees don't have to certify that they're DEI-free, though the Trump administration has appealed. Jane Valinga says it's hard to imagine what the future will look like.
We don't know what to think. I mean, we feel like we're in limbo.
What she finds so ironic is that even after decades of agitating, women still make up less than 5% of the skilled trades workforce nationwide.
You cannot look at the workforce of the construction trades and say, oh, they've taken DEI too far.
She says you look at the workforce and you see women have a long way to go. Andrea Hsu, NPR News, Chicago.
The scientist E.O. Wilson once wrote that ants are the most warlike of all animals. He said clashes between ant colonies could dwarf the battles at Waterloo and Gettysburg. But sometimes, instead of mass combat, ant colonies get conquered by stealth and deceit. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports on how an ant colony can be tricked into betraying its queen.
For an ant colony, the queen is a big deal. She lays all the eggs. The workers protect her and raise the young. After a colony has been around a while and gotten bigger, some of the offspring will be females that are capable of reproduction. These females fly away and try to establish new colonies. Eric Frank is an ant expert at the University of Würzburg in Germany. He says the founding of a new colony is a precarious, fragile time. The would-be queen faces a lot of danger as she's out there on her own, laying the eggs that will produce her first workers.
Even one small mistake or one bad luck event that kills off your workforce can mean the end of the colony.
So, the females of some ant species avoid this risk by doing something tricky. They simply find an established colony, one that belongs to another queen. They kill off that queen and take her place so they can enjoy the protection and care of all of her workers.
It is very efficient.
Keizo Takasuka is a researcher at Kyushu University. He and some colleagues in Japan recently saw some female ants using a particularly devious method of defeating a reigning queen, which they describe in the journal Current Biology. First, he says, the female ant had to acquire some camouflage.
So she could invade into the colony.
Since ants mainly tell friend from foe using chemical signals, the researchers let the female ant have contact with some worker ants from a colony so she could get exposed to their scent. After obtaining that, she was able to creep undetected through the colony, right up to the queen. Then the female ant shot jets of fluid from her abdomen, dousing the queen in some kind of chemical before retreating to a short distance away. Takasuka says they haven't identified the chemical yet, but
it's my guess. It is formic acid.
That's used by some ants to signal danger. Whatever it was, putting this chemical onto the colony's queen had a dramatic effect. Swarms of workers who had been lovingly obedient, ready to protect her with their very lives, abruptly turned on her. They violently attacked her until she was dead. Eric Frank, the ant researcher in Germany, wasn't part of the research team, but he watched a video of the intruder's chemical spray and the colony's subsequent betrayal.
Obviously, there's absolutely zero benefit for the host colony to kill their own queen.
The only benefits went to the invader, the female ant that was now able to assume the throne.
I'm not surprised that the behavior occurs, but it was very cool to see.
He says usually this kind of royal ant drama happens underground in the dark, which is why ants rely so much on chemical signals and why they're vulnerable to this kind of trickery. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Programming is supported by Lake Country Power, a Touchstone energy cooperative, providing the energy to help power ideas and strengthen rural development throughout northern Minnesota. More at lakecountrypower.coop. Lake Country Power, energy that powers our lives. Now it's time for the Up North Report.
For KAXC News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. A man is dead and a Cass County Sheriff's deputy was hospitalized after the two parties exchanged gunfire near Walker Sunday afternoon. In a news release, the Cass County Sheriff's Office says they responded around 5 p.m. to a 911 call reporting gunfire around Onigam Road and Old Agency Trail, about 4 miles northeast of Walker. While attempting to contact a man seen walking on the Onigam Road, a man fled and a foot pursuit ensued. The release says there was then a, quote, exchange of gunfire. The man was pronounced dead at the scene, and the deputy who was shot was flown to a Fargo hospital via helicopter. The investigation has been handed over to the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. The agency declined to comment amid the open investigations in the region. This is the third law enforcement shooting in the region in the last 4 months. Last week, a Clearwater County deputy shot and killed a man in Bagley. A Walker police officer shot a knife-wielding man at a Dollar General in August. The deputies involved have been placed on critical incident leave. One of the companies involved with bringing a proposed data center to Hermantown requested to pull its permits from future agendas. In a November 10th letter posted on Hermantown's data center project webpage, Minneapolis-based Mortenson Development wrote that it is taking, quote, the public's requests for more information seriously and plans to host an open house to facilitate open dialogue on the project. No date or venue has yet been announced. Development on the project has reportedly stalled since the city responded to an October petition for an environmental assessment worksheet. Hermantown officials already approved a rezone for the project area, but the environmental review was challenged in court earlier this month. The Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy joined the grassroots Stop the Hermantown Data Center group to demand further review for the large-scale data center. The city of Bagley is considering two wide-ranging options for the future of its police department. The Bemidji Pioneer reports a packed Bagley City Council meeting last Wednesday as council members deliberated whether to add more police officers to its two-person department or disband entirely to contract with the Clearwater County Sheriff's Office. No formal decision is expected for several months. The provision to disband was originally introduced in October. Several Bagley residents spoke out against their police department disbanding, the Pioneer reports. The topic is likely to come up in future meetings, with the Bagley City Council meeting at 5:30 p.m. on the second and fourth Wednesdays of the month. Northern Minnesotans won 3 medals at the state swimming and diving meet last weekend. Megan Buffington has more.
The two student athletes who medaled are the same two who broke section records on their way to state. Park Rapids junior Avery Schuler finished 3rd in the 50 freestyle and 5th in the 100 freestyle, and Two Harbors senior Bella Imholt took 7th in the 200 freestyle. Only the top 8 medal at state, but Imholt also won the consolation final in the 100 backstroke, and Schuler and the rest of the Park Rapids 200 freestyle relay team also finished 9th. Additional swimmers and divers from Brainerd, Detroit Lakes, Hibbing, Bemidji, Rock Ridge, and Park Rapids competed in the consolation finals. Find the full results at KAXE.org.
The last 4 Northland football team seasons came to an end last week in the state semifinals. Here's Megan again.
Defending 9-player champions, Fertile Beltrami lost to top-ranked Hills Beaver Creek 30-14 on Thursday, and Kitson County Central nearly came back to beat Hillcrest Lutheran Academy, scoring 2 touchdowns in the fourth quarter, but the Bearcats fell short, losing 27-21. On Friday in 4A, Grand Rapids also attempted to mount a miraculous comeback with a 2-touchdown fourth quarter that saw the Thunderhawks recover 2 onside kicks, but Cass and Manorville won 16-14. Minnomanwaubin was the last Northland team standing by Saturday, but they couldn't keep up with the 3-time defending single-A champions Mineota, who haven't lost a game since 2022. The Thunderbirds lost 28-14. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at KAXE.org, where you can also find content from our music, phonology, and morning show teams. Sign up for the Buzz newsletter for the week's best stories and audio from your favorite community radio station. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920.
You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation. Streaming at BritBox.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Saudi Arabia's crown prince is meeting President Trump at the White House on Tuesday. He's traveling with an entourage of 1,000 people, from top ministers and security officials to Saudi business leaders. And as NPR's Aya Batrawi reports, when the two leaders meet, they will be talking about billions in Saudi investments and a coveted U.S. defense pact.
Expect a flurry of deals, a dinner, and a major investment forum when Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman meets President Trump in Washington. And there's much to discuss, including the war in Sudan and the ceasefire in Gaza. Trump told reporters there's also Saudi Arabia's ask for F-35 fighter jets, which only Israel currently flies in the Mideast.
Yeah, I will say that we will be doing that. We'll be selling F-35s. Yeah.
A major Saudi defense upgrade like that will likely be tied to a bigger ask from the president, a normalization deal that establishes diplomatic ties with Israel. But Saudi Arabia's crown prince is in no rush to strike a deal with Israel right now. Paul Salem, a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, says Prince Mohammed, also known as MBS, has to consider Saudi public anger at Israel's war in Gaza that began October 7th, 2 years ago.
So what was possible before October 7th for Saudi Arabia is absolutely no longer possible, and the crown prince says it to his interlocutors straight out. That yes, maybe I would be interested in doing it even without major concessions, but I can't. MBS is a very popular leader among the younger generation, and he wants to keep it that way.
So while the crown jewel of Trump's Abraham Accords deals remains elusive, the trip could produce a Saudi defense pact with the U.S. at a time when Iran's under pressure and could retaliate against Gulf Arab states if attacked again by Israel. And for the two leaders, this trip to Washington fortifies their personal ties, or what analysts say is a transactional relationship girded by business. Raghda Derham, chair of the Beirut Institute think tank, says there's a blurred line between Trump's family business and his administration.
They don't hide it. You know, they don't make that a secret. They think this is part of what happens anywhere in the world. But it's very unlike the traditions of the United States because you separate family from country. But I think with the Trump presidency, sometimes family first.
There are several Trump-branded golf courses and towers being developed across the Gulf by a private Saudi developer. And the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, got seed money to start his private equity fund from a sovereign wealth fund overseen by the crown prince. $2 billion worth, according to the New York Times and Wall Street Journal. The White House says there's no conflict of interest and that the president's not making money off his position, that he left a life of luxury for public service twice. For the Saudi crown prince, this trip to Washington marks a turning point. His last visit 7 years ago came just months before his aides killed Saudi critic and Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. At the time, the prince was shunned by the West. And despite a continued clampdown on critics, Trump has hailed him as a great leader who stays up all night trying to make his country better.
He tosses and turns like some of us. Tosses and turns all night. How do I make it even better all night? It's the ones that don't toss and turn. They're the ones that will never take you to the promised land, won't they? But you have done some job. True.
That was Trump speaking in Saudi Arabia in May, where he was met with pomp and fanfare on his first overseas trip of his second term. He'd arrived in Saudi Arabia with a huge entourage of top American executives. They all lined up to meet Prince Mohammed. And as he did then in Riyadh, Trump is expected to use tomorrow's meeting at the White House to say that the big money deals signed with Saudi Arabia create jobs in the U.S., just as the economy is forefront on voters' minds. Aya Boltraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
When communities rebuild after a disaster, they can sometimes be out of reach financially for the people who lived there before. Parts of Florida, for example, are still recovering 3 years after Hurricane Ian swept across the state, and residents are finding that rising home insurance costs are making it more expensive to live in harm's way. NPR's Michael Copley has more.
Jackie Lezak owned a little yellow hotel steps from the water in Fort Myers Beach. When Hurricane Ian slammed into the Barrier Island in 2022, the storm washed away the Sea Gypsy Inn. The business is just a memory now. Between rising insurance costs and tougher construction codes, Lezak says rebuilding doesn't make financial sense.
All of the boutique hotels that are on the island that were washed away, they're all in that same boat.
Lezak runs the Fort Myers Beach Chamber of Commerce. She says the storm also drove away longtime homeowners. And there's little hope the store clerks and bartenders who once lived on the island will be able to afford to anymore. In their place, a lot of locals expect more big resorts and expensive homes built to handle punishing weather.
That gentrification is a real thing. The change in the cost is a real thing.
That's Rob Fowler, a local builder.
And it all adds up to the fact that, only well-heeled players can play now.
The changes unfolding in Fort Myers Beach are an extreme version of what's happening throughout Southwest Florida. The region already had a shortage of affordable housing when Hurricane Ian hit. Rising prices for home and flood insurance have added to the problem, leaving a lot of homeowners struggling to get by. It's a problem that's also facing other communities around the U.S. Home insurance costs are going up nationwide, partly because climate change is contributing to more extreme weather that damages and destroys property. In downtown Fort Myers, several miles inland from Fort Myers Beach, Jessica Gatewood is seeing the impact in her real estate business.
Right now, majority of what I see is that they're pinching every penny to pay that mortgage every month.
With lots of homeowners trying to escape crushing insurance bills, Gatewood says home sales have slowed and home values are falling.
If this economy continues on like it is for another year, yeah, for sure, we're going to have a lot of foreclosures.
Renters are getting squeezed, too. Melissa Caballero says rent for the one-bedroom apartment she shares with her husband has doubled since they moved to Southwest Florida a few years ago. Now she's thinking of leaving Florida after watching her niece move away and find cheaper housing in Ohio.
Little by little, you're going to see everybody going away. Anybody that don't have that money enough to be able to pay rent, people are going to have to move.
Back in Fort Myers Beach in October, nail guns echoed along the island's main road, where new houses and businesses were going up next to vacant lots and the shells of buildings still gutted by the storm. In the evening, Dixie Fish Company was packed with diners. People lounged on the beach as the sun set. Some sat on pilings of the town's broken pier. A couple danced in a plaza nearby. Scott Safford says the town's going to make a comeback.
And the guys that are investing now, that are stakeholders now, are going to reap the rewards. It's just taken longer than we ever expected.
Safford's a town councilman in Fort Myers Beach. He's also married to Jackie Lezak, the head of the Chamber of Commerce. He worries national chain brands will replace a lot of the mom-and-pop businesses that characterize the island. But Safford knows the town needs more investment to survive.
We're going to need development to sustain the tax base.
Fort Myers Beach also needs some luck with the weather. When Lezak thinks about the rebuilding that's still left to do, she's afraid that another big storm will come before the town's ready.
That will chase away all the investors. That will chase away the people who do want to come and live here for their little piece of paradise.
And she says that would set the town's recovery back by years. Michael Copley, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In San Antonio, Texas, a group of Latina grandmothers in their 70s and 80s have formed a dance troupe known as Las Abuelitas de Oro. The name is inspired by the popular sitcom The Golden Girls. Texas Public Radio's Ivana Bass Caldera tells the story of how these grandmothers reignited their love for dance by forming a folklorico group that performs regional Mexican dances.
On a bright Sunday morning at a city park in Texas, Las Abuelitas de Oro elegantly grab their long, colorful dresses and sway them as they dance to a set of traditional Mexican songs in front of a few dozen people. Dolores de León Savage is 85 years old. She's been dancing since she was 3. For decades, she owned dance studios. Now, as a retired dance teacher, she helps older Latinas stay in touch with their Hispanic culture.
When we perform, we just go out there and, like, we're teenagers, even though we're in our 80s. Because, you know, yeah, we do have pains and aches and everything, but, you know, when we're dancing, everything is gone.
Las Abuelitas became a formal folklorico group just a year ago, and they offer free performances year-round throughout San Antonio. 73-year-old Michelle McDonald was born in Cuba and raised in Texas. Her journey with dancing began at 7 when she learned ballet, jazz, and flamenco. She stopped dancing after her career as a dental hygienist, marriage, and raising a son took priority. After retirement, she took on folklorico.
I always like it when they call out the age. They say, we've got a group here from 73 to 86, and you can hear the gasps in the audience. I love that.
Sandra Rodriguez stopped dancing after high school. She worked in banking, married, and raised 2 children. Now at 73, she says folklorico brings her joy and helps her stay healthy.
It helps with our coordination, with our balance, with our memory, you know, because we have to remember our steps, what's next. So it's all very good for our health.
The group practices at least 3 hours every week. Part of their mission is to pass down their culture to newer generations by teaching folklorico to an elementary dance group known as Los Rayitos de Sol, or Little Sunbeams. These students and the abuelitas perform at the San Antonio Park to the songs Guadalajara and Jesucita en Chihuahua, while the sun highlights the dancers' vibrant Jalisco ribbon dresses. Rodriguez, who goes by Sandy, says being a part of the group has helped these women find a purpose post-retirement.
Working with the children has been just fantastic. They're beautiful, and they're so eager to learn, you know, and the dancing, they love to dance, and then, you know, we're showing them our culture.
Las Abuelitas are refreshing their dancing set and rehearsing to perform during Las Posadas, a Catholic tradition in Latin America commemorating Mary and Joseph's journey to Bethlehem before the birth of Jesus. For NPR News, I'm Ivana Vaz Caldera in San Antonio.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. KXE was chosen for NewsMatch 2025. It's a national campaign supporting local nonprofit newsrooms like ours. You helped us get here, and now your gift can go even further. We have over $35,000 in matching funds to support strong local journalism across northern Minnesota. Your gift will be matched 3-to-1, up to $1,000 while funds remain. The campaign runs through the end of the year. Give now at KAXE.org. Programming on KXE is supported in part by the Minnesota Humanities Center, distributing more than $6 million in cultural heritage grants. Funding is available to individuals and organizations that will create, celebrate, and teach Minnesota's diverse arts, culture, and heritage, including indigenous organizations, historically underrepresented communities, and recent immigrants and veterans. Details at mnhum.org/grants. Mountain Iron Buell Drama and Chair present Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, November 20th through the 23rd, at Merritt Auditorium. Find tickets and showtimes at chair-mn.org. Kotaska Community Action offers free lunch every Wednesday from 11 to 1 at their Circles of Support office, located across from Treasure Bay Printing on Northeast 4th Street in Grand Rapids. They also offer a food pantry from 11 to 2, Monday through Thursday. United Way of Northeastern Minnesota invites high school seniors to write an essay on the biggest need you see in your community and your ideas to address that need. Open to those in Coochiching and Lake of the Woods County, plus the entire Iron Range. Find more at UnitedWayNEMN.org. The deadline is January 1st. Now back to All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Voters in Ecuador delivered a decisive rebuke to their young president over the weekend, voting no in a referendum that, among other measures, would have allowed the return of foreign military bases to the country. President Daniel Noboa had campaigned hard for the measure, backed by strong support from the Trump administration, which had hoped to expand its military presence along Ecuador's Pacific coast. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports.
Supporters of the No campaign celebrated in the capital, Quito. With 100% of the votes counted, the measure to bring back bases, in particular U.S. military bases, lost by a wide margin. Voters also rejected measures to cut public funding for political parties, rewrite the Constitution, and reduce the size of Congress. But for many, the vote was a referendum on President Daniel Noboa.
Es un presidente que no tiene credibilidad.
He's a president without any credibility or professionalism, and the country is worse off than ever, said this voter in Quito, Carlos. He asked we only use his first name because he was fearful of repercussions at his workplace for talking about politics. Last night, Noboa did not address supporters. He posted on social media that he respects the will of the people and will, quote, continue fighting tirelessly for the country. Noboa says he needs the U.S. military bases and international cooperation to fight the transnational drug gangs that have taken over large swaths of Ecuador. The country has been enveloped in a violent crime wave, with homicides, kidnappings, and extortion surging. But Ecuadorian security analyst Michelle Maffei says Noboa was stubbornly focused on military methods to fight the gangs. She says he needs a more holistic and robust security strategy.
He lacked on that, even though every single specialists in Ecuador warned Noboa that going towards only a militaristic approach was going to have a counterintuitive result. He didn't listen.
And homicides have surged. On average, 25 people are being killed in the country every day, according to government figures. Noboa has deployed the military to fight traffickers, imposed repeated states of emergency, and just recently opened a maximum security prison for gang leaders. Maffei says while the U.S. may not be putting military bases along Ecuador's coastline, cooperation between the two countries continues. What Noboa has to do now is work harder on rooting out corruption and going after the drug traffickers' assets and money laundering capabilities, something, she says, Ecuador has not done. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Bogota, Colombia.
So when did our human ancestors start making tools? Well, the earliest artifacts that we know of date back more than 3 million years. But early finds have been scattered and inconsistent until new findings from modern-day Kenya. Researchers had studied a site there for 15 years and uncovered more than 1,000 artifacts, tools made and used by early humans continuously for 300,000 years. David Braun is the lead author of this new study, recently published in the journal Nature Communications. He's a professor of anthropology at George Washington University. Welcome.
Thank you.
So just describe these tools for us, because we're not talking about like axes or arrows or anything like that, right?
No, these are relatively simple tools. It's basically a rock that has been hit
probably by another rock, to make small chips of stone, but they have sharp edges on them. And those sharp edges provide the ability for early humans to cut things in ways that they can't do with either their teeth or anything else. And that is a kind of a pretty dramatic change in terms of their ability to access some resources.
So cool. So these are like the earliest known knives, if you will.
Yeah, that's a pretty good way of describing them.
And why is it a big deal that early humans were building basically the same tool over hundreds of thousands of years?
The fact that we see a very similar technology for such a long period of time suggests that early humans are at least like learning from each other about how to make these over an extended period of time. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they were teaching each other, which is kind of a very human thing to do.
Yeah, these weren't like apprenticeships happening, right?
Exactly. Yeah. No, there's not. We can't know whether or not they're doing that kind of thing. But the fact is that they're actually learning from each other is kind of important, because what we as humans do really well is we transfer information between each other.
Yeah.
And so this is one of the first times we can really see that maybe they're doing that at a pretty high level over a very long period of time.
So how does that change the way we think about our ancestors?
What we can say from our findings is that early humans consistently use this technology over this relatively long period of time in the past, which suggests it's not just sort of a one-off kind of invention and then it disappears, which is what we kind of thought was going on with the early record, was that maybe early humans just invented it and then didn't do it for a long period of time.
Huh.
So that kind of changes the way we think about it a bit.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this project, because it took over a decade and you excavated these finds in modern day Kenya. They were analyzed in the Netherlands. Did you expect this work to take that many years?
No, not at all. We did the initial survey in about 2012. But, you know, this is in a very remote part of the world, right? It takes us 3-4 days just to get up to where our camp is. And so it does take a long time to actually accumulate the evidence. In this instance, what the difficulty was is that we kept excavating new places. We thought they were the same age, but it would take, you know, 6 months for the samples to get to the Netherlands to be analyzed. When we finally got the results, we realized actually those are not the same age. And so over several years, we had to kind of hit and miss as to what we were actually finding until we could determine that there's actually quite a sequence of different sites, things that we initially thought were about all the same age.
That's so fascinating how painstaking it can be. To confirm these kinds of findings. Well, what remaining questions do you have about these particular finds now that the paper is out?
I think one of the surprising things that we identified was that it is a very simple technology. However, to be able to make these things consistently, you really need to understand something about stones, about different types of rocks, because they selected very specific rocks to do this.
Oh, wow.
So that would suggest that this is maybe not their first rodeo, right? Once we realized just how old these were, we started thinking, well, we should probably be looking even older in the archaeological record.
David Braun is a professor of anthropology at George Washington University. Thank you very much. This was so interesting.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Workday, an AI platform to manage HR, finance, and agents that aims to free business leaders from the mundane so they can focus on more meaningful work. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. Weather tonight, mostly clear skies, lows in the mid-teens, low 20s. Tomorrow,